Welcome into another edition of the Dan and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I'm Rick, he's Dan, and Dan, it's Monday, January 18th. We're recording this around noon, and it's a little bit before either of the polls have come out. When they do come out here in a little bit, I think we're going to find out that Xavier is a top five team, at least in the AP poll. Let's start there. On the list of priorities as a fan, where does that rank for you? What's this like, having a top five team in the country?
It's cool. It's cool to have the national publicity that they're getting right now. I think it's great for the guys on the team to get that national recognition for Coach Mack. It certainly can't hurt recruiting efforts. It can't hurt the profile of the school. But I think that the big glass ceiling for Xavier's basketball program to break through doesn't have anything to do with the Associated Press or with the USA Today poll. It has to do with making a Final Four, competing for a national championship, and I'd even throw in competing for a Big East championship into that mix as well. So yeah. While it's a neat development, it's certainly an unexpected development. I don't think it's that hugely significant.
Yeah.
Compared to the other goals.
Yeah, I can definitely see where you're coming from on that. I will say the thing about this that I think gets cooler is the longer the season goes on, the neater this is, right? Like, because the last time they were ranked seventh, which was the highest they've been ranked, was the year of the brawl. And they were ranked in non-conference. You know, it was early in the season. You get some teams have played weird schedules to that point, all of that stuff. It's a whole lot less significant than we're starting to get towards the middle of conference season. No teams at the top have clearly separated themselves as a dominant favorite. You keep watching these teams more and more, and the feeling you keep getting more and more is that Xavier is very much as good as the rest of these top five teams in the country.
Yeah, that's the way more significant thing is when you sit down and you watch, say, Michigan State this week gets hammered at home to Iowa, and Iowa's a team that was at the same at the Advocare Invitational with Xavier and lost to Dayton in the first round, a Dayton team that Xavier beat by 100 points 3 days later. When you look at,
Michigan State lost to a bad Kansas team just this weekend too. I mean, a bad Wisconsin team. I'm sorry.
Yeah, bad Wisconsin team. And I think that Kansas and Oklahoma probably are the two most impressive teams I've seen. But beyond those two, and then Villanova, who obviously rightfully should have the advantage over Xavier, even though they have an additional loss because of their blowout win in Philly. There's not really anybody else that has a compelling argument to be ranked ahead of Xavier at this point, and that's pretty cool. I will say this, though. I mean, I think in order to truly believe that Xavier is on that elite level, that it is a national championship contender, I think I'm going to have to see them beat Villanova at home on the 24th of February or something like that, because the one thing about this schedule is although Xavier has a very good schedule and there's a lot of good teams on the schedule, Villanova is the only team from that cadre of elite teams that they play. Whereas, like, the ACC teams that are ranked in the top 10 of KenPom, they play each other. So, like, North Carolina, Virginia, Duke, you know, they're going to get some touches against teams of a similar skill level. And, of course, Kansas and Oklahoma already played that incredible three-overtime game. Oklahoma beat Villanova in the non-conference. So some of these teams have intersected a little bit. We've seen matchups between two teams that could be rightfully considered in that top category, whereas Xavier's only real opportunity is against Villanova. And that first game was, as you and Brian discussed on New Year's Day on the last podcast, was kind of a wash because of the Sumner injury and the way that psychologically obviously had a huge effect on the team. I'm not sold 100%, but all signs are pointing in a positive direction.
You brought up an interesting point there, not to go too far down this rabbit hole, but say they win out the rest of the Big East slate except for that Villanova game. They play tough, lose to Villanova by 5 at home, we'll say. Where are your feelings at going into the postseason? I mean, I completely get what you're saying. If they don't beat Villanova, that is kind of, you know, that is the one elite team they have on their schedule in conference. Where do you feel if they do lose that second game to Villanova?
If they win the rest of their games for the rest of the season, and that means going away to Providence, Creighton, Butler, and Seton Hall, all of whom are top 45 KenPom teams, and the only blemish on their schedule is Villanova, and they're sitting at, what, 28-2 going to New York?
Yeah.
I'm going to start thinking that it's more of a Villanova thing than it is a Xavier is not ready for that elite level thing. If they go to all those hostile environments and win, and to be perfectly clear, I don't think they're going to go all those places and win.
I don't either.
But if they go to all those places and win, then yeah, then it's just a question of which region are you the number one seed in, and can somebody else knock out Villanova? And then it's all wide open as far as I'm concerned.
All right, let's move on here a little bit. You know, talking about some of these games, we haven't talked, like you said, since the Villanova game, and you and I didn't even speak after that one. So there's some different things to hit on. But let's start with James Farr. He struggled there for a couple games in a row, starting sort of around that Villanova game. Mac called him out after the DePaul game. I thought it was somewhat interesting because it was very direct and a little more pointed than Mac typically is, although, you know, he doesn't pull a lot of punches to begin with, but he was very direct in saying James just flat out wasn't good enough and needs to be better and things of that nature. James responds with 16-19 against a good front court in Marquette. It just played an unreal game. Some of the rebounds he was grabbing were just ridiculous. Completely makes the 1-3-1 zone so effective because it'd normally be difficult to rebound out of that type of defense, and he has no issues with it and really boosts the effectiveness of that defense. I think he exposed Henry Ellenson on D when they made that big 21-0 run in the first half. He buried him in the post a couple times. I mean, the one he caught the ball about 7-8 feet off the block on the baseline, dribbled, backed him in about 6 dribbles, and then finished with the hook shot over the middle of the lane. The other interesting thing in this game, he showed confidence with his jump shot, which we haven't seen a whole lot this year. It may have been developing recently leading up to his struggles, but then all of a sudden we saw it again in this game, which I think is really interesting for this team, because if all of a sudden you can put him at the 5 and start stretching the floor with him too, and he has the confidence to knock down that like 12, 15-foot mid-range jumper in space, especially against like a zone or whatever, Wojo's face when he hit the second jump shot was just like, what the hell are we going to do now? Because it really just makes Xavier impossible to guard if they've got the 5 stretching the floor as well. What are your thoughts on James Farr at this point?
Yeah, I think it may have just been a situation where James had a rough game. I kind of am throwing out the St. John's game because it was such a weird situation for the team. It came so easy to them early, and then St. John's was doing things they'd never done before, and the X really found it difficult to get back into high gear. That game was kind of a write-off, kind of a one-off. The DePaul game, you know what? Guys are going to have bad games, and that was the bad game for James. I don't necessarily agree with Coach Mack that his effort was poor in the DePaul game, but I do think that his production was off, and maybe he let some of his offensive struggles in that game affect him at the other end. But obviously that Marquette game, he came back in a big way against what's really the strength of Marquette's team, which is those two talented young big men. And like neither Ellenson or Fisher really had any response for James on either end of the floor. And I think that was huge for the Musketeers in getting a win over a Marquette team that to me is very dangerous away from home.
Yeah, absolutely. On the effort thing, I think with James, sometimes it's more about attitude, and Chris mentioned that. And one of the most impressive things this year to me has been James's attitude, because he's never been a very like emotional on the court type of player, a guy that is an energy giver. You know, he's not a guy that his teammates have fed off of in the past. He's been more of like an Eeyore type figure on the court. You know, he mopes at times a little bit. And I think a lot of that is due to he wasn't always happy with his role. But somewhere along the line, about midway through last year, he definitely changed and just seemed to have this appreciative mindset of, no matter how long I'm on the court, I'm going to be the best rebounder I can possibly be. And that's where everything seemed to start changing for him and really started to see a lot of progress be made. I think Max saw, not only in those few games where he struggled, but also in the practices during the week, that he didn't have that same attitude, didn't have that same energy, maybe started feeling a little entitled because he was playing whatever. I don't know what it was, but you know, I think Mac was right to call him out and get him back on track. And you just can't say enough about the way James responded, because his just the when he's grabbing rebounds and screaming at the other team's bench, screaming at Marquette's bench, that's a James Farr that, I mean, that makes this team really, really good. And it was a James Farr that I didn't know existed until this season. So I think that's important. Any thoughts on the NBA talk that's been going on the board the last few days regarding him? Did you have a take on any of that?
It's tough for me to see. I don't know. I never have any idea what the NBA is really looking for. I mean, it always has seemed to me that NBA scouts covet physical ability over necessarily, you know, want to or production at the college level. And there have been a lot of guys through the years that I've thought have been really tremendous ball players at the college level that never really got a look in from the NBA. And then there's guys who I would have thought never would make a career in the NBA that are still there 10, 12, 15 years later because they have, you know, one particular skill that is elite. So I don't really have an opinion, I guess. I wanted to ask you, Rick, about the I had a take on the DePaul game. And I missed the game. I was traveling for work. But I saw on the tweets a lot of people talking about how the crowd was dead. And on TV, it was pretty evident that, like, a lot of the lower bowl was empty at tip-off. Is it time to end the 6:30 tip-off experiment?
Well, I just don't think it's going to happen because of TV. I mean, when they stack those two Big East games together, I think they're still going to do that on early weeknights. You know, I mean, on like Tuesday nights, I think they're just going to keep that 6:30 game there because of the way it works out for TV.
This is where I'm going. I think everybody would agree that keeps track of these things, that the TV ratings for the Big East have been pretty disappointing for FS1. Is that fair to say?
I think FS1 overall isn't necessarily I don't think they're as good as they'd like them to be, but at the same time, they've improved and they've helped us FS1 as well. But go ahead.
I guess my thing is, if you're selling to advertisers and to viewers, the Big East, basketball crazy schools, elite atmospheres, elite teams, and then you have a 6:30 game at one of the best, home court advantages in the league, and you know you're playing it so close to the end of the workday that half the crowd isn't there, or you know those that haven't had, let's say this euphemistically, sufficient opportunity to get rowdy yet. I think you're kind of defeating yourself. So my thing is, why not do 7 and 9:30 and have those? You've got four teams in the central time zone in this league. For them, a 9:30 home game is an 8:30 tip, which is reasonable. So why not do it that way? I guess I would like to see them move away from that. But that's just a quick thing. But yeah,
I think you have a very legitimate point. But I would also argue my take after that game was I felt that fans were just getting a little like, it's DePaul, we're a top 10 team in the country, and it's not like Xavier came out there and played their best game in the world. You know, there wasn't like that flurry where there was super exciting basketball. I just kind of felt like the fans were like, this is kind of a ho-hum game, to be honest. Because, like, it's not like there weren't 9,700 people there that could have made plenty of noise. And the students were back.
Just sort of a generic thing over these last three games, I kind of have gotten the idea that that's been sort of the way all three of them have gone. Because if you think, especially about the DePaul and Marquette games, these were games that were not really blowouts. I mean, DePaul got that way toward the end. But for most of both of those games, they weren't blowouts. But by the same token, the other team never really looked like they had any chance of winning the game either.
Right.
So it kind of, and really the St. John's game was that way too until the little Italian kid whose name I can't remember,
Messini,
starts knocking down ridiculous threes and all of a sudden drags them back into that game. So it almost feels like X has been kind of managing these last three games, you know, maybe not going all the way up the gearbox the way that we've seen them earlier in the season, or we saw them say against a higher caliber of opponent like a Butler or a Cincinnati or a Michigan.
I think that's very much the case. But here's the thing: to me, those are the games that suggest that this team is really good and suggest that this team is much better than it was last year. Because to me, these are the games that last year's team couldn't win or struggled to win, even at home. You know, these were last year's DePaul games, the St. John's, the different games where they struggled to win, close games on the road, couldn't finish. Those are the games this year that they're finishing off and they're in control of. And it may not be super impressive, but go around and look at the rest of the country when they're playing on the road, you know? Like, yep. I said, Michigan State lost to a bad Wisconsin team on the road this weekend. It's tough. It's tough to win on the road in a good conference, and Xavier's in a good conference now. These are the games, you know, when you don't shoot well and you go to Marquette and just handle them. I mean, you're up by double digits the whole second half. Everyone on the message board was worried before that game, you know? And then afterward, it's like, oh, man, played a bad game. It's like, I mean, missed shots, but I don't know that I would call it a bad game. Like, that was a really good effort to be in control of that game the entire time.
At 15-6, it sure didn't look like it was going to be an easy win. With Xavier starting out shooting about as poorly as they have all season long in the first couple 4-minute wars of that game, then they go on a 21-0 run, and then it was so weird after that 4-point play where Marquette got it from 14-10 shortly before halftime. It was like the lead never went. It was like either it was between like 7 and 14 for the rest of the game. Neither team seemed like they could score back-to-back baskets. And so Xavier really managed that. I wanted the biggest talking point to the Marquette game, Rick, is the return of Edmund Sumner. What do you think of his effort in that game? And where do you think he's going to be as we head into a big week with home games against Georgetown and Seton Hall?
No, I mean, first of all, great return. He didn't miss a beat. 15-5 was, you know, a really, really nice game. I love his confidence and his pacing on offense right now. Like, the way he'll just pull from three, the way he's looking to just attack people off the dribble, off of ball screens, is awesome. Just that he has that level of confidence already, and he's starting to figure it out. But I also really like, you can see how he's gaining feel, and he's understanding how to play a little bit more. I mean, he's pushing the pace of the offense a lot faster than he was early in the year. And I'm not even talking about, like, in transition. I'm talking about on, like, a normal half-court set. Just watch the way he blows through half-court and comes up with a lot more pace. And then he comes in that first drag screen, and the defender's already on his heels. Like, he's worried about Edmund just going past him in a straight line to begin with. He stops, gets a drag screen, goes around it. These defenders can't stop and change direction like he does. I mean, he's really starting to figure out how his weapons benefit him, and I think the coaching staff has done a good job of continuing to tweak things as he gets more comfortable and as he, you know, settles in and his turnovers have lessened and he looks more and more confident. They've started adding more of the subtleties, here's how you can use this to your advantage, and here's how you can create more separation from defenders, things like that. I think they've done a great job with that, and we've started to see that come out in the last few games. To me, I think Edmund's close to that point of being a go-to kind of dominant player, and this team just doesn't really need him to yet, which is a great situation to be in. You know, you talked about where, you know, they're kind of going to be at going forward. What's he going to mean to this team? I think it could be like, I think he could very much be in that role Samaje was in his freshman and sophomore years, where he is the offense. I think he's ready to do that. But again, you just don't need it on this team. So he's going to be a great weapon. He's going to be a tremendous complement to Trayvon. And at times, you know, we've seen the games where Trayvon can't hit shots or Miles struggles to make shots. In those games, I think that's where we're really going to see Edmund shine the most and where he's going to be most important to this team, because he can still create offense when guys aren't hitting jump shots. And that's a tremendous thing to have at the point guard position.
Yeah, and that's definitely been an issue in Big East play for the Muskies, is they haven't quite been where they want to be as far as 3-point shooting. You know, they're a they're shooting roughly the same percentage, but some key guys on the team have really struggled from 3-point range in conference play, particularly J.P. McCura and Trayvon, who I believe is only shooting about 30% in league play. Rick, let's you know, we've kind of hit on some of the positives from the Marquette game. One ongoing situation that's kind of been worth keeping an eye on, I feel, has been Jalen Reynolds over the last couple of weeks really has had some, what would be the kind way to say it? It's been kind of variable what they're getting from him. He had a great game against Butler, 13-8. Against St. John's, you know, he had 10 points, 13 rebounds, really dominated the glass in that one. But against DePaul, a little bit of a struggle, only 6 points, got himself in foul trouble. Against Marquette, again, major foul trouble, only played 14 minutes in that game and only scored 5 points. And it seems like Kaiser Gates, by contrast, is getting more and more time and getting more and more of that sort of those 40 minutes that we talk about from the five, or the maybe 55 minutes total for the bigs, given that sometimes Xavier will double up with two bigs. What's the situation with Jalen? I mean, where do you feel like things are right now with him?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think there's two different things going on here, and for Jalen, the situation is a lot more dire than it is for Xavier. For Xavier, it'd be really nice. I mean, this was a guy who was supposed to be a leading contributor to this year's team. He was a guy who helped lead last year's team into the Sweet 16 and was a force that looked like an NBA player in the postseason. He was a huge boost to this group last year. So if they can get him playing back at that level as one of the best big men in the country the way he finished last year, that'd be huge for a team that's already really good. So that's sort of one part of this, which is, you know, it gives this team more upside. They don't necessarily need him to play great. They've played really, really well at games that he's been non-existent. So I don't think it's the biggest deal in the world. I don't think they necessarily need Jalen to get back to that level. But if he does, it gives them even more upside and improves them. But for Jalen, on the other side of things, he's got to figure it out. It's like, you know, we're 4 years into this thing and it's the same stuff every year. I didn't expect this from him this year. I really didn't. And the things of, like, you know, you mentioned the St. John's game. It's like, yeah, you put up a decent stat line, but if you recall, that's the game he was benched to start.
Yeah.
Because of his attitude and not getting things done and, you know, all that stuff that Mac's been calling him out for. And I think that's a good job by Mac. I mean, you saw what it cost the Bengals in the postseason this year, if you don't nip those things in the bud now. Like, that stuff's important. Being reliable, being accountable is important. And I think it's important that the rest of the team sees Mac hold Jalen to those standards and hold him accountable in that way. But for Jalen's sake, he's just got to figure it out. He doesn't want to come back to school next year. I understand that. That's fine. I don't think anyone's going to hold that against him. But it'd be a shame if he didn't come back to school next year and he didn't really have any good options. You know, if he's going over to play in Israel, like, that should not be how he leaves Xavier. I hope it's not. And I don't think it's over. I think he has enough time to put together. I mean, his numbers aren't bad right now, especially on this team. People understand that he's not going to average a double-double on a team that's this talented. So his numbers are good enough that if he really, you know, this is when people are really paying attention. The postseason's when you really get your exposure. If he turns it back up and gets back to that level that he was playing at the end of last year, I think he'll be fine. But at this point, how can you be confident that he's going to? You know, I'm not saying he won't, but it's up to him at this point. I don't think it really changes a whole lot for Xavier one way or the other. But man, if he does get it together, it'd be great. Do you have any thoughts to add on that? Because I've got another guy I want to ask you about.
All I would say is that Jalen has had a tendency throughout his career to kind of drift in and out of the mix.
Yeah,
and I don't know if it's an issue of maybe he gets bored. Maybe these midseason games were, you know, three straight games against pretty, I mean, I wouldn't say that they're boring opposition, but they're not elite caliber opposition. Maybe it's just kind of like the doldrums, like they talk about in baseball, like in August, when everybody just can't stand each other and they just want to get to the significant games. I don't know. But I agree with you. I mean, he's in a situation right now where if he, you know, if Jalen is doomed and determined that he doesn't want to come back to school, which is, by the way, his option, and he's, and nobody can realistically spite him for that, given that he'll have graduated, I believe. But if he really doesn't want to come back to school, he's got to figure something out, because right now I don't know that European teams, at least those that pay worth a damn, are as big on raw talent as maybe NBA D-League teams might be for a guy with that skill set. And I don't know that he's done enough in college to merit a look in that situation. So he's kind of like in this weird tweener area. Now, granted, I'm not an NBA scout. I don't know what he's being told by the people that advise him, family and friends and so forth, AAU coaches. But he may be forcing himself into a situation where his best option is to suck it up and come back to school for a fifth year.
It may be. Right now, every indication I have is that it'd be hard for me to believe that'll be the case. But that being said, you know, right now, like I said, he's not giving himself a whole lot of other good options. Like he's not going to have the pro prospects that he wants to and thinks he's going to have with the way he's played so far this season. And the biggest thing to me, like you said, he's been a guy that drifts in and out, production wise and how, you know, focused and everything he is. And that wouldn't be as big of a concern if it was, he was putting up these numbers and it was just kind of inconsistency that was plaguing him. But my thing is, he really hasn't shown up yet. Like, he's had good games, but we haven't seen Jalen, like the dominant Jalen yet. He hasn't had a great game, a game where you're like, you know, keep James off the court and just leave Jalen out there for 30 minutes yet. There hasn't been one performance that's been, there's the Jalen we saw against Arizona. You know, there just hasn't been one game like that. So until he shows me that, I would be concerned about where the season's headed for him personally. Let me ask you about one other guy. What do you make of Remy Abel's season right now? He 0 points against Marquette, 0 against DePaul, 6 against St. John's. He's really kind of just struggled offensively, and outside of a few games this year, he hasn't been much of an offensive contributor, which was kind of expected, I think, coming into this year to begin with. But then you look at what he's done kind of in bigger games, you know, 15 at Michigan, 11 against Dayton in the finals of the Advocare, 21 against Butler, had a pretty good shootout. It was 3 for 5 from 3-point range, had 9 points. Where are you at on Remy Abel? I'm not saying, you know, that you need to be like concerned about him right now or anything, but like, is he having a good senior year, or is this what you expected from him, or is he not playing as well as you would expect? Where do you come out on him? Because I'm having a hard time assessing his performance so far.
This is going to sound weird, but there are games where I almost forget that he plays for Xavier until he does something, you know?
Yeah.
Because it feels like all the attention is given during the games to more spectacular or notable players who do things that get eyes on them, like McCura, like Blewett, like Miles Davis. I think Remy has been, even though his scoring output has gone up and down, I think he's been relatively steady. I think you're getting exactly what you thought you would get from him on the defensive end. And, you know, he's got an unconventional jump shot. That's just the bottom line. And it's one of those things where if something, it's like a golf swing, if something slightly mechanical is off, it's going to look pretty ugly. And he's had a couple pretty bad shooting days in a row. But, you know, maybe he gets back to Cintas Center this week. Maybe he gets one to go down and snaps back into place. If he's a guy that can hit the odd three, that can score in transition, where he remains one of the best finishers on the team, in my opinion, and then play, you know, balls-in-the-wall defense, he's going to continue to get minutes on this team. So how do you assess his senior year? I don't know. It's hard to say because it's all kind of on feel based on how he's fitting into the team concept on defense, how he's keeping the ball moving, less so than things that you can sort of tangibly measure, like points and rebounds and offensive rating and things of that nature.
Yeah, it's funny. For whatever reason, I can't help but continue thinking that if he were on another Xavier team in the past, he would have been a really important piece that fans were really relying on, you know, each game. Like, he would be the guy. I think he would have been one of the best players on a lot of Xavier teams. I think it just kind of speaks to the depth of this team again that, like you said, you can just not even notice him and not even worry if he goes out and doesn't score at all, doesn't shoot the entire game. Not even really a concern if you're a fan right now.
I mean, and this is one of the things, by the way, his importance to the team is underscored by the fact that if you look at the minutes, I think he's getting the third most minutes on the team.
Right.
Behind Trayvon and Miles.
Yeah, he's still getting it done defensively.
He gets a lot of run, and I think the reason why he gets a lot of run is because when Xavier's playing man-to-man, especially when Ed was out these last couple of games, when Xavier's playing man-to-man, if Rennie or Larry Austin isn't on the court, they don't really have, like, that plus ball defender.
Right.
So Rennie is so critical to this team when they play in their base man-to-man.
They're very susceptible to penetration if he's not on the court. Like you said, Larry, Edmund, and Kaiser, that combination now have made things a little bit better, too. But, yeah, I completely agree with you there.
Speaking of Kaiser Gates, I think it merits just a little bit of discussion how good he's been in the role that he's developing into over the last couple of weeks.
You read my mind.
Against DePaul, I texted you about he had a couple on the ball defensive plays against Billy Garrett that were just absolutely out of this world for a four guarding a quick guard like that. And his versatility, I think, makes him really useful to Xavier, because not only can he play on the ball, you can switch ball screens on the perimeter with him out there because he can guard everybody. And then in the 1-3-1, you can either play him up top, you can play him in the middle. I think you could probably put him under the basket, depending on the lineup. And certainly you can play either wing. So I think that his development has been one of the really, you know, the team is 16-1. They're way better than any of us could have imagined them being. So it's hard to think of something that's not like a pleasant surprise about this team. But Kaiser Gates might be one of the most pleasant surprises about this season, or at least about these last couple of weeks.
I mean, that was exactly where I was going next. And my wow moment was for Kaiser Gates was exactly what you just mentioned, which is he comes into the game against DePaul guarding Tommy Hamilton, a 6'10", 250-pound center. Now, granted, not your traditional post-up physical center. He's a little soft for a guy that big.
250. What is it if he puts his other foot on the scale?
Well, he's dropped a lot of weight. He was like 300 pounds when he got there. We'll say down to maybe 255, 260, but he's definitely slimmed up. But either way, he comes out guarding him, which I thought was a little interesting to begin with. Like, wow, that's, you know, some trust that to put him on someone that big. And then the first ball screen that Hamilton goes and sets, he seamlessly switches on to Garrett and harasses Garrett out on the perimeter and cuts down his penetration. I was just like, my goodness, like, if he can go out there and guard one of the best point guards in the Big East with no issues, and he did it like three or four times where he switched onto him, that's pretty darn impressive. And not only that, but, like, he's getting in there on the boards. He's mixing up in there. He's a dead-eye shooter, but he's just really – you can see the confidence and the aggressiveness just building with the more and more time he gets on the court. Had a career-high 18 minutes against Marquette. Also, just with him in that zone, the 1-3-1, he can play any spot, the wing, the top, the middle, and he makes them better because of his length and his quickness. You know, Xavier's playing that 1-3-1 just over 30% of the time now, and I just never thought – we'd see a Chris Mack team play this much zone. But with the personnel they have, it's so effective. And the way they run it that I think it's becoming a staple. Like, I just don't – I even going past this year, I think it's something we're going to continue to see him use. It's kind of just becoming his thing, a hallmark of one of his teams, I think, now.
Yeah. Well, let's look forward a little bit, Rick. 13 games left in the regular season. X is 4-1 in conference play. They're a game and a half behind Nova, who's 6-0. And then there's a big group of teams with two losses right behind them. Then Butler 2-3, Marquette 2-4, and DePaul and St. John's pulling up the rear. Xavier, not probably arguably has not played the most difficult conference schedule so far. I think if you look at the KenPom conference strength of schedule, they're 8th out of 10 teams. And actually, if you look at these last 13 games, I think it divides pretty seamlessly into two sets of games. The next six games, they have three games against Marquette, DePaul, St. John's, so games that they're going to be pretty big favorites in, even though the DePaul game's on the road. They also play Georgetown and Seton Hall, who are very good teams, but they play them at home, where Xavier's had a massive home court advantage. And the only one of those games that you might stick in the toss-up category is Providence. So you look at these next six games, and there's an opportunity here for Xavier to continue this incredible start. I think 5-1 is certainly doable, and you could see a situation where Xavier even wins all six of those games, given that Providence has already, I believe, lost twice at home in conference play this year. However, those last seven games are absolutely murderous, and I'll just walk through them right now. This is just something to keep in mind. But at Creighton, at Butler, home to Providence, at Georgetown, home to Nova, at Seton Hall, home against Creighton on March the 5th. That is as tough a series of games as Xavier's ever played in its history. So you kind of got to make hay over these next six games if you're Xavier. And I think it starts tomorrow night against Georgetown, a team that early on in the season, after they had played pretty credibly against Maryland and Duke and then beat Syracuse, I thought was going to be one of the better teams in the Big East. But frankly, they have not been that good, I don't think, this year. They haven't been as good as we imagined they would be. You know, they took that loss to Radford early at home, which was kind of just a shocking thing. You could call it an opening night freak accident. But they also lost to Monmouth at home in blowout fashion. They lost to UNC Asheville at home. And in league play, they really don't have any impressive wins. They played DePaul twice already. They won at home against Marquette. They beat St. John's away, but St. John's, as we know, is pretty bad. And they got beat bad at Creighton, and they lost at home to Villanova in a hard-fought game. So where do you assess Georgetown? Where are they right now? And how do you think that this is where do you see this game tomorrow night going?
Well, so first of all, I didn't like this Georgetown team as much coming into the season. I've been down on them from the start, and the reason is the same as I thought Xavier owned them a lot last year, which is they don't have a point guard. They still don't. I mean, they turn it over a lot. Here's the other thing. They can't rebound. They're okay on the offensive end. They have some out-of-area guys that go and get the ball on the offensive glass that you got to box out. But defensively, they don't finish off stops with rebounds. They don't defend the three well, and they foul incessantly on the defensive end. For those reasons, I think this sets up very well matchup-wise for Xavier, and the fact that it's at home, obviously, as you mentioned, is Xavier has a huge home court advantage. But, I mean, this three-game stretch here is difficult in itself. I mean, you mentioned kind of the next six games, they have a good chance to go 5-1 or 6-0. I do think that's true, but this is not these first three games in that stretch where you go Georgetown on Tuesday at home, Seton Hall Saturday at home, and then Providence Tuesday at Providence. Not an easy stretch by any means. You know, obviously, I just said I think they're going to win that Georgetown game, but then Seton Hall on Saturday may be the toughest of the three. I mean, the fact that it's at home helps, but Seton Hall may be playing the best out of those three teams right now. They defend really well. They're not the greatest rebounding team either on that end, so I think Xavier could gain an advantage on the offensive glass. They also turn it over a lot, don't necessarily have a steady, reliable point guard, but they have Delgado on the glass who gives them some size, and he can maybe contend with James and Jalen and Xavier's rebounding ability a little bit. And they have talented guards in Whitehead and Carrington and Rodriguez and even Gordon, I like, who transferred from UMass. So I think that's going to be an interesting matchup. I think that's going to be a tough game. And then, as you mentioned, you go to Providence. Providence, I thought this was a tough place to play, but as you've mentioned, they've already taken a couple L's at home this year, and matchup-wise, they're an awful shooting team. They're really good defensively, but on the offensive end, I tend to think, you know, we talk about how difficult it may be to match up with Chris Dunn, guys like that give Xavier trouble. Ben Bentel has been great in the post, but I think this game probably ends up being one that we see a ton of 1-3-1 again. And that's kind of, you know, one of the teams Xavier used it well against last year. It kind of takes Chris Dunn's penetration out of the equation a little bit, turns him into more of a jump shooter where he's not as good. So I think that that's another game that sets up matchup-wise pretty well for X, even though I think Providence is a good team. So I think they can definitely go 3-0 over this stretch, but I don't think it's going to be easy. And if they drop one of these three games, it wouldn't be a huge surprise to me. Dan, one of the things, you know,
Which do you think is the toughest game?
I think Seton Hall is the toughest matchup. I think Providence at Providence is probably objectively the toughest game to win, just because you're on the road, and Providence is a pretty good team too that presents some matchup issues. But if I were to just pick for Xavier specifically, who do I think has the toughest personnel for them out of those three teams, it would probably be Seton Hall. One of the things is when I'm watching, you know, some of the tape and all synergy and everything, seeing these teams and looking at these other Big East games, I like a lot of these teams, but I find myself saying a lot about the Xavier team, just like, I don't think that's going to work against X. Like, when I'm watching them do things defensively, I'll just be like, oh, yeah, like, they are good at that, but I just don't know that that works that way against X, just because of the way X has different options and spreads the floor, and they can just do too many things. I think they're just really difficult to guard, unless you're just a extremely long and athletic team. It's going to take elite talents playing well, I think, to beat this Xavier team, or it's going to take an off night from Xavier, obviously.
All right. Well, anything else you wanted to hit?
No. I mean, I think that does it. I know you're on lunch break here at the office, so we won't keep this thing going any longer. I think that's all we need. I guess we'll see you tomorrow night at the Georgetown game. You've been listening to another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.